with that introduction. Right, so the subject of our workshop is, of course, galaxy formation, which is basically a sweep. It's a code word for the formation of nonlinear structures of various sorts. The cosmic microwave background, observations of that impact on this in a number of ways, some absolutely directly in the sense that we can use various microwave background observations to tell us in detail how structures are forming in the nonlinear era. For example, galaxies that are booming out in the infrared, where star formation is very active, clusters of galaxies upscatter microwave background photons and give us structure in the microwave background that we can go after, and distortions of the spectrum. And there are other things that we are trying to target with the microwave background that also tell us about nonlinear structure formation, which is what this is about. However, microwave background impacts in a number of other ways on the issue of structure formation in the universe, and in particular, even on the nonlinear structure aspects. And so I want to sort of go over these different roles that the microwave background is playing. One is the spectrum of the microwave background. This has been one of the great successes of microwave background observations. As you know, it's essentially a perfect black body. Now we've discovered small distortions from that black body, and they tell us a number of things. And I'll go into that as we proceed. That's the sort of average temperature information as a function of wavelength. The other information, which is the one that's very exciting right now, is delta T over T, the microwave background angular fluctuations on the sky. And this is what delivers to us a treasure load of information on the early eras of the universe, cosmological eras. And what we know and knew basically quite early on, just from constraints on the fluctuation level of the microwave background, is that the level is about 10 to the minus 5, we now know. What that means is that the fluctuations in the density at the epoch at which the photons were released, which is about a redshift of 1,000, those fluctuations are clearly in the linear regime, which has been the enormous simplification. We shouldn't underestimate how important this has been for cosmology's development, that there is this vast regime of linearity that allows us to actually do very explicit calculations that are the precursors for the absolutely fundamental nonlinear work, which is hard and dissipative, and there are feedback mechanisms. These are the points that this workshop is discussing. So microwave background, the observations of anisotropies have been delivering us a lot of interesting cosmological information. Over time, from the early to mid-80s, we were dealing with upper limits. They kept ruling out quite large classes of theories already and provided quite a bit of focus of our theories. The great development was, of course, the DMR discovery of 1992 of the fluctuations. And that focused our attention a lot on certain classes of cosmological models. And now we are moving into the very high precision cosmology game, which will ultimately be determined by the satellites. The MAP satellite goes later this year, believe it or not. And the Planck satellite, 2007. But before that, there have been these great long-duration balloon experiments. One has flown with perfect. It was a perfect flight, quite amazing. So apart from the great skill of the experimenters, there's also a tremendous amount of luck. And to many of you are experts in the microwave background in the audience, and so I thought that it would be appropriate to keep you entertained while I go over very basic things about the microwave background and how it fits in. The entertainment is that I am allowed to do this in part because I'm part of the Boomerang team. I'm an underling. The Boomerang is ruled by individuals who are called graybeards. There are a number of... The graybeard is a rather curious title. given that the young John Rule here, you can't quite tell, but he is a gray beard, and he is here to oversee the proceedings and make sure that no classified information gets out. So you will not be hearing about, what are they called, peaks? But you will be able to see something which is pretty exciting for those of you who are aficionados. So I will be going back over the microwave background stuff, but I'm just going to show you something to whet your appetite about what's coming up. And one of the things that's going to be the focus, at least for some of us at this meeting. So when you look at the famous sort of football kind of picture of the all sky, remember that what Kobe did, what you have is a galaxy at the center. This is the plane of the galaxy, the North Galactic Pole, the South Galactic Pole. The southern part of our galaxy is down here. The northern part is up here. You know how you wrap this around, and so you're looking at you just wrap it around, and that's what you see all through the sky. What Kobe did was to deliver information of fluctuations on the scale of 7 degrees and above, which is a pretty crude thing, but it was obviously an extremely impressive result. What we're going towards is the attempt to resolve the structures that Kobe began to see all the way down with all the angular structure down to about 5 minutes of arc, which is what the Planck satellite will be doing all sky. The map, so that's 2007. 2000, the MAP satellite will be doing all sky with a resolution of about, oh, maybe 11 minutes or 12 minutes of arc. What the Boomerang long-duration balloon experiment, which flew last December in the South Pole, went around perfect flight, it did a region something like this on the sky. And so it went through the galaxy, but it has a lot of usable data that is non-galaxy to try and determine the fluctuation level of the microwave background. And its best resolution is about 10 or 11 minutes of arc. And there are a number of frequency channels. And so some of you may have seen this before, but it is spectacular. This is some of this region. You see a little bit of the galaxy and down below it. This is 150 gigahertz, not far from the peak of the microwave background, added to 240 gigahertz, so two channels, both quite clean. This is the difference between them, showing that the structures are basically seen in both maps, except when you get towards the plane of the galaxy. This is minus 10 degrees in galactic latitude, minus 20 degrees. When we analyzed the Kobe data, we were using a galactic cut, which was minus 20 degrees, which was a little fuzzy also to get rid of a few objects, so that this is sort of the region in which Kobe made its big cut. The resolution here, these are three quasars, and the quasars are pretty well resolved here, and so that gives you an idea of, roughly speaking, what the beam size is. And so you can see that there's a lot of amusing structure here. And so those of you who can do Fourier transforms in your head know quite a bit of information already, but I'll draw your attention. Fortunately, and the key pieces of information which you, you cannot get. For example, details of noise level. Somewhat more, I mean, that's a very pretty map. This one takes away the average of the 240-150, takes away from a 400 gigahertz, which is the channel which is more prone to determination of dust. So this is like getting rid of the small residual foreground. And I like this other one better because the ups and downs sort of more clearly shown, but this is the best map that currently exists of the microwave background, but it's preliminary as you see. Okay, so I'll just leave that up here. Oh yeah, so there is one thing that John said I should try and show. or that he always shows. John, feel free to interrupt to and feel free to censor me at any point. I'll get bleeped out here, right? Okay, so this is, you probably can't see this, well, maybe you can, I don't know. So this is 90 gigahertz, and this is the best map. And so this is a completely independent piece of information. Here are the three quasars lining up here. And as one moves this a bit, you can see that the structural features are all there. So that's pretty good, pretty interesting. So I thought that while I do more general things and chat about microwave background, those of you who are bored might stray over there. This is about 30 degrees and beam about 11 minutes or so. That means this is of order a degree. That's not an uninteresting scale, as we shall see. This is the galaxy. Yeah, so this is galactic emission. Oh, sorry, yes, right. So this, the colors just came out better in this one. Okay, so now we're going to take a step back, and I'm going to talk about microwave background generally. And but we're bearing this in mind as what microwave background is delivering to the subject of galaxy formation. Okay, so the first thing that, so I'm going to put some more numbers on to whet your appetite. This has got nothing to do with this data. Do not take it away assuming it does. But all of the data but this gives us currently, from the microwave background alone, rho total over rho crit, closure density of the universe. I assume everybody sort of knows what omega is these days. 0.96 plus or minus 0.09. There is another number which I'll put into context as we proceed, which is within the context of the initial fluctuation generation mechanism, what the slope is, which is almost a scale invariant form.
So
yeah. Okay, so that's just for microwave background alone. In other words, it is starting to deliver on the promise. I'll be mentioning more about this as we go along. Glad you're doing this one.
As much as just reducing the statistical uncertainty is just, you know,
this is all of the experiments up to date, not including Boomerang 1998.
That's the super messy Doppler plot.
Right. And so this is now, I want to put these numbers into context, but that's just to give you where we're at. Okay, so the first thing I... Okay, I'll put this more into context as we proceed, and I think you'll see what's happened in this. So it's, I think the emphasis should be on the heterogeneity of the data sets. That is to say, but you know, you might say statistically they're all going to sort of cancel out and give the right answer, all the errors. But I think it's much better to deal with one data set if you can, and that's. Just to put, well, if you want, if you just do the North America boomerang flight, this is the number you get. So you see things can walk around quite a bit. That was the test flight. So that was the one that was just announced in November. And it's about a 40th of the data. Less.
About 4 hours of CMB data versus about 250 hours.
Not exactly. Or if you can, I would like to hear the techniques. Okay, no. So now I want to put this into context. So this was just to give the experts in the audience whetting their appetite of where we're trying to go to and what we're trying to explain. Okay, so the first thing about the microwave background and galaxy formation is the information on the spectrum. So it's one of the best black bodies ever been measured, interestingly enough. It gives an average temperature as a function, average temperature of 2.725 plus or minus 0.001 degrees Kelvin. That is to say, a tremendously accurately determined average temperature now. We get out of that much of the context of the hot Big Bang model, of course. That tells us what the entropy is. The number of background photons that this translates to is about 412 per cubic centimeter. That's the number that are surrounding us at all times. The energy density in this is 0.26 eV per cubic centimeter. So this is what is surrounding us. So that's one thing that we get out of observations of the spectrum, this essentially perfect black body. But then one can be interested in the distortions away from that black body. And there are a number of ways that that can manifest itself depending upon when structures form in the universe. So let me just give the general constraint on the energy that can have been injected relative to this amount of energy in the microwave background. Is less than 2.5 times 10 to the minus 4, which means that you cannot tolerate a huge amount of energy having been injected. It's not sense which redshift. It's in the range 400 microns to 5,000 microns. Yes. I'll get to that in a second with a general graph. Yes, all right, so maybe I should begin with that. Okay, so the way to try and put some of this into context is, first way is to look at a sort of past light cone diagram of when different things occur that the universe expands. So we're up here looking back. This is our past light cone. And the subject of our galaxy formation of the galaxy formation session here is to deal with stuff which is up here on our past light cone. So when we do all of the observations, Simon probably talked about this, all of the observations that we more or less have for large-scale structure in the universe, you know, the patterns of galaxies, etc., most of it's focused really locally. But the things that have been very exciting, and this is what Simon talked about in the first Blackboard presentation, is that try and do these things in some sort of marginally logical fashion here. One of the things that's opened up very interestingly is, when did the great clusters of galaxies form? And it used to be that we saw them down here near us, but we had anecdotal evidence that there were big clusters at high redshift, but we didn't have samples, and that's beginning now. This corresponds to redshift, let's say, 0.4, say, to 1 or so. And this is the epoch of the formation of big clusters. And as it goes back further, there is an epoch associated with the formation of bigger galaxies. And as one goes back further, there is, when did the first objects in the universe form? You sort of call this the first star regime, but they correspond to really tiny galaxies that would have formed in the universe. And as you go back further, there is the epoch. So this might be redshift about 10 to 15, this redshift about 5 to 3, and down below 2, say. And this is, let's say, redshift 1 to 0.5. The microwave background decouples from the photons at redshift about 1100. This is slightly later, depending upon the specific model, when most of the recombination of the hot plasma in the universe recombined, which is just back a little bit from this point. So there is an epoch between when the microwave background photons were released and when the first stars were formed. This has been called the Dark Ages, and one of the goals of this program is to try and figure out what methods we can use to try and probe this region. And one of the methods is to use the microwave background, various observations of the microwave background, to try and get a handle of the passage of the universe from the dark into a period. What we know as we look out is that around this period of galaxy formation, we know that the universe was ionized. And so sometime between here, when the photons recombined, and here, that ionization occurred, and we would like to find out when. That's an extremely important issue for how structure formed in the universe. Our current view is that it was probably associated with the formation of the first stars. So can we use the microwave background to try and get a handle on this? And the answer is yes. It hasn't given us that much of a handle yet, but that's one of the goals. There is a region relatively close in distance to this period when the photons decoupled, which is the cosmic photosphere. And if energy is injected in the universe at a time which is earlier than this, the reactions of scattering and redistribution of the energy are fast enough so that no matter what entropy you stuck in, it would re-thermalize into a Planck distribution. So by observations of the microwave background alone, we can't tell when the entropy of the universe was generated, if it was earlier than this point. And of course, we believe that it was earlier than this point, which is a redshift around 10 to the 7th. So there is this period in between in which we have what you might call an electron scattering atmosphere, where these hot photons, which have been thermalized, they cease to, basically it's like a cloudy atmosphere. And once you get down to redshift about 1100, the reactions of the electrons, which is just photon-electron scattering, are such that the universe expands, the density falls, and the photons ultimately can be released. Yeah. So earlier than that, the photons can redistribute their energy by reactions of the following type. Photon plus electron, this is the basic Compton process, except that you can change the photon number by a bremsstrahlung off of a Compton process. Similarly, electron plus proton is also a significant process back then. So this can cause it's strong enough back then that it can redistribute the energy you inject. Okay, so this is the early epoch. Now, when we... Okay, right.
Strong enough between 1100
and 1700. No. So it's back here. There are various explicit forms of calculable distortions in the spectrum that occur between this point and this point, which we've looked for in the COBE data and has not been found, only upper limits. They have specific signatures, and so the limits are actually better than this in terms of the amount of energy that can have been injected to distort the whole energy of the microwave background. There is an extremely important one, in fact, and I'll even write that down. which is something called Compton cooling, that all of the microwave background photons, of which there are a huge number of them, there are about 10 to the 10th for each baryon in the universe, they're sitting there, and if you've got hot electrons, those hot electrons can scatter off of the microwave background photons and cool down. And that leaves an imprint on heated photons. It's called Compton cooling. And relative to the total energy in the CMB, this energy is less than 6 times 10 to the minus 5, which is a very serious constraint on how energy can have been injected in the history of the universe. So these things that came from the COBE data, and this is sort of vintage 19, or at least began vintage 1990, although the final results and the final numbers I'm giving were not actually given till actually last year. This one is a very recent number, as one did further and further analysis of the data. What this has told us is that things that were reasonable ideas before do not operate in the how structure formed in the universe. So, for example, an idea that seemed totally plausible is that hydrodynamic phenomena could have been responsible for a large amount of the structure that formed in the universe. So, for example, when you form galaxies, the galaxies can create supernovas. They can create a lot of supernovas in a short time, and that can cause a supernova, through supernova explosions, you can generate a blast wave, and if it's not big enough, then it probably can't break out of the galaxy. But if you sum a lot together, you could have broken these shock waves outside of the galaxy, and they would then propagate in the intergalactic medium, and what they do is that they can cause matter to plow together in a shell, which has got a delta mass over the mass of the galaxy itself, which is of order unity or beyond. They can sweep up quite a bit of mass, and so a very reasonable idea was that that can fragment and produce new objects, that there was an amplifying factor, essentially a hydrodynamic instability. That has now been very strongly ruled out by this data. That cannot happen. We do believe that energy injection is an important aspect of the formation of structure. This is in our subject here, the subject of the workshop. It comes under the name feedback, and everybody's talking about feedback, but what they're talking about is energy injected, which has perhaps important roles to play over small distances, but not over the sort of huge distances to create the kind of structures that we need to see, or that do exist in the universe. Yeah. It doesn't actually require that much energy to reionize everything. So it's all completely consistent with these things. So, so that isn't actually a problem. Well, first of all, as you know, you have to inject the energy quite early for Compton cooling to be relevant. So you're dealing with redshift 20, 30 or so, but down to 15, for that to be the dominant cooling mechanism. No, it's not even close. No. I might say that an interesting number is that clusters of galaxies give values for this, which is, in our basic, the basic models that are what we call concordance models, the preferred models for structure formation based upon a whole variety of data, they give values which are just a little below 10 to the minus 5 here. But this is not strong enough a constraint to actually rule out any issue. The more relevant thing is to try and get a constraint on when the universe reionized from observations of the microwave background, which I'll mention in a bit. Okay, so that's perhaps enough for the energy issue. I'll go on a little bit to the fluctuations in the microwave background, and then I'll try and put everything into context by some vast Bondian diagram that I am known in I would not say loved for, but you will be. It's marginally entertaining. The microwave background fluctuations are a function of angular scale, and the way we actually prefer to deal with these is to resolve them into the YLM components on the sky. So we do a spherical harmonic analysis, and so basically L is some characterization of how different angular scales are entering, and there is a quantity which is the power spectrum in microwave background fluctuations, which is usually independent of the M component of the, it depends upon the model, but for most models it's independent of M. We call it CL, it's the angular power spectrum, the microwave background fluctuation. And there is this famous diagram, which I'll be showing again, and I'll just be doing one of them. We multiply by a prefactor, which is irrelevant, in order to make a graph which everybody in our subject now knows and loves. For models that are our typical models, it looks something like this. This is log of L. There is a flattish component. This is the region that the DMR satellite saw arise, some oscillations with damping. And this scale, depending upon the model, is around 200. And the coefficients is corresponds roughly to a degree or so. Kobe saw out to L of about 30 or so. And all of the action is down here right now. That's what, if you take this scale and you translate it, you might know something about this. Okay, so this is a target, and microwave background fluctuations have been extremely useful in putting constraints on things. It turns out that if this period here, by the way, all of the other data apart from this shows that we have, I'm exaggerating one way or the other of the error bars, but basically it appears that we have fairly strong evidence for a downturn and a peak from all of the data put together. And in fact, even from individual experiments, it is pretty clear that's true. So this is a triumph in itself, but you know, maybe the data isn't going to fully show that as we get to higher and higher precision. That remains to be seen. However, one of the things which is very significant is that the microwave background fluctuations here, they're predominantly associated with fluctuations that occur when the photons are decoupled. Basically, what happens is that the photons are decoupled on a surface, and that surface has various compression or rarefactions of the photons as they're released. That's one of the dominant effects for seeing microwave background fluctuations. These are acoustic oscillations associated with the photon baryon fluid that exists back at this time. There is another effect, which is also interesting, is that when the photons are released, they may be flowing toward, or the baryons may be flowing towards us, or they may be moving away from us. That's a redshift effect, and that is also imprinted. It's called the Doppler effect. And a combination of the two are what define this detailed structure. As well, there is another phenomena that occurs at smaller angular scales, which is associated with the gravitational redshift. The gravitational field can cause a redshift. Larger scales, smaller L. You may know that in general relativity, a light cone would not be a straight line, but it would actually be rippled. And so photons propagating to us along our past light cone move in and out of the ripples. Now, if the ripples don't change in time, that doesn't change anything. But if the ripples change in time, that can change the nature of the microwave background fluctuations, and that can change this regime here. So there are lots of interesting effects. The important one in terms of understanding this peak here is the nature of acoustic oscillations back at redshift about 1100 when the photons are decoupled, so that they're very, they care a lot about the sound speed at that epoch. The sound speed at that epoch is mostly dominated, if you just take these numbers and ask at that epoch, how much energy density is there in photons compared to baryons? The energy density, they're about the same at when the photons decoupled. The speed of sound is C over root 3. It's a tightly coupled photon fluid, except that there is some inertia associated with the baryons associated with it. And for typical parameters, it lowers the sound speed to about 0.8 of that. Details of this are extremely important. This depends upon how many baryons there are in the universe. And so we can use observations of these microwave background fluctuations to try and nail this, and through nailing that, nail various cosmological parameters like the baryon density. Okay, I will talk about this a little bit more as we proceed. Well, I'll talk about it now. This is one physical effect. And so I think maybe the interesting thing to do is to tell you what the physics is that defines this peak. The angular scale of the peak, first peak, assuming there are other peaks, is determined by sound, and it's determined by how length scales associated with how far sound moves over a Hubble time at this period, over an expansion time of the universe at that period as the photons are decoupled, we have to translate that distance into an angle because L is a multipole moment on the sky. It's an angle. And so geometrically, there is a well-known relationship in cosmology which is called the angle distance, or the angular diameter distance relationship, which we all know and love, which translates from angle, or inverse angle in this case, to sound crossing distance at that time, or Hubble, or sorry, sound crossing radius, sound crossing horizon is the terminology. Instead of an ordinary horizon, which would be multiplied by C times the time, basically, it's C over root 3 times 0.8 times the time. So now I will take a slight step back and introduce wave number. I'm not sure that this is what you're going to be asking about. Okay, we know from the microwave background fluctuation, by the way, the level here is measured in, it's the square of 10 to the minus 5. Delta T over T of 10 to the minus 5. This is at 10 to the minus 5 level. This is higher, about 6 times 10, well, a few times 10 to the minus 5 squared. That is the thing that told us that we could do perturbation theory because we're in linearity. If you resolve things in the universe into eigenmodes, those eigenmodes are characterized by wave number. And so we use, in our game, wave number as opposed to length scales. Not only that, what is logical is that because the universe is expanding, we take out the expansion. And so instead of using physical wave number, we use one with the expansion of the universe taken out. So that the when we resolve fluctuations, we talk about it in terms of a co-moving wave number. And so fundamental to our entire description, because we're in a linear regime, is that we do calculations wave number by wave number in the linear regime before the high nonlinearity and coupling occurs. And so it's a fairly straightforward, if somewhat technically tricky, calculational procedure. So the basic aspect of these acoustic fluctuations is a really simple oscillator equation with appropriate damping that's major effect is like cosine Cs times K times the co-moving time back then. And there are some appropriate factors that go in front of this, something associated with damping, which is an important fact as well. But basically, the bottom line is that this is the fundamental quantity, which is just a simple wave-like phenomena in terms of oscillations. And K is a length scale. It is the appropriate length scale back here. And the length scale, and this quantity is basically the sound crossing, the horizon sound crossing at that epoch. And so what we're trying to do is to say basically KRS is something like pi. Translating that into angle now gives a relationship which has a pi and what we call an angle distance relationship divided by the sound crossing horizon back at that time. Okay, all that being said, this thing depends upon cosmology, depends upon how curved the universe is, because what happens is that an angular scale back here, so I've drawn for a specific case the nature of the past light cone, but in fact, if it's an open universe, a large distance becomes a small angle, and if it's a closed universe, a small distance becomes a large angle. What that means is that, and I think that if any of you went to Ken Minkowski's talk, you probably talked about this a lot. For an open universe, this, by this geometrical effect, moves in this direction. And for a closed universe, it moves in this direction. It's a fairly strong effect. And so by finding out where this resides, we tell about the geometry of the universe. And so that's one, I would say, of the in this past year, that's been an emerging triumph of the microwave background, is those error bars have come down. And so let me give you some numbers over a vast variety of different shapes here. L peak. A year ago, the value was 250 plus or minus 20. That compared with what is called the concordance model, which, interestingly enough, has non-zero cosmological constant, which is what the data is pointing us towards. So I'm just giving a few parameters of the model that I'm talking about here. That compared with something for that model, which is 212 omega total minus a half. And so what we were able to do a year ago was essentially determining this quantity, reading off this graph, and finding that omega total was preferred to be somewhat less than unity. The two pieces of data came along since then, this past year, one from an experiment high in the Chilean Andes, and the other one was the boomerang test flight. And both of those gave values which were a little lower than 200. And so this is the problem in dealing with heterogeneous data sets. Things start to move around a bit, and so that's why we want... In any case, when they're all combined together, curiously enough, the number is 215 plus or minus 15. And 215 in this, essentially, although this is a completely different analysis, lead to this number. So that's what you're going to get about peaks. Now, that tells us quite a bit of information. But other really interesting information is how far the peaks are separated, which through this kind of law is well defined. Right? We know what the separation should be, and we can learn things about it. And that's also sensitive to the sound crossing horizon. Yes, relative heights. Relative heights, absolutely. No, damping's extremely important. Okay, so the damping, basically, if the photons were released perfectly so that it was like a brick wall, suddenly the photons were tightly coupled and then they were released immediately, these things would not be damped. So they'd just keep going on. However, the length scale associated with this is about 10 megaparsecs. And What that means is that the photons that are able to scatter through the period of when they're predominantly decoupled, that turns out to damp these things down. There are two reasons for this. One is because it's just the photons propagating through this fuzzy atmosphere. But the other point, and it's actually, they're about roughly the same effects, is that a nice way to think about it is that there is a viscosity associated with the photon baryon fluid that becomes quite significant right here, and so that the baryons themselves, as they're trying to drag away from the predominant photon gas, are causing damping to occur. And so that's the reason for this, and it tells you a lot about the physics of what's going on, this relative damping scale. There are also interesting ways that things interfere between the velocity flows and the compression and rarefaction, which tell us even more. So relative heights here to here, here to here, they tell us even more. And so as you open up the data, you can get a handle on more and more cosmological parameters. And so that's the name of the game. And what the Planck satellite will do for these predicted theories is it'll be able to go down with extremely high precision all the way out here to, let's say, L of beyond 1500. And data that we are discussing is dealing with situations up to 700 or so, and that's potentially beyond, if peaks were there, it would be potentially beyond more than the first peak. Say no more. Okay. It's basically just it's basically just the multiplier. It's about 400. Yeah, more or less. Yeah, it's not as precise as that because the mapping from K to L is not as straightforward as a single mapping because it's a 3D to 2D projection. So it fuzzes things out a bit. Yeah. Of course, it's extremely important. Because we're in a high precision game right now, it really now matters. It's a very complicated thing how the hydrogen recombines here because it's a situation that you weren't used to thinking about because there's so many photons floating around. So it turns out that one of the predominant mechanisms is two photons from the 2s to the 1s level being responsible. But that has been understood more or less since 67 or so, just after the microwave background was discovered. But what we've learned is that you have to do not just the hydrogen recombination with accuracy, you have to do also the helium combination with accuracy. And this has been, these were, when we had our 95 program here, microwave background was one of the big topics of discussion where we were trying to get all of these things down. Following from that, Douglas Scott, who's at UBC, he has done, believe it or not, 100-level hydrogen atom models in order to try and get a really good handle on this. And it actually does make a difference. And so you can see this response in these CL curves at the few percent level, which is what we're trying for in terms of accuracy. So, and not only that, the helium recombination matters as well, which is at a slightly higher redshift, but enough to have an impact. So the neutrons and protons do count. Okay, so this is largely the linear regime issue. And we can learn all sorts of things from the microwave background. The claim is, and we've made these claims, in an ideal world, if we understand everything about foregrounds, et cetera, which we think we know a lot of, and in fact, this is a diagram which illustrates it might not be such a bad thing, that the foregrounds might not, from the galaxy might not be killing us. For the Planck satellite, the claim is that in a typical class of models with 9 independent parameters, we should be able to determine a combination of 5 of them to within a 1% accuracy, which is an amazing thing to look forward to. And the long-duration balloon experiments plus DMR will go some distance in that direction, not nearly as good as Splunk will do, nor even as MAP will do, but it's not bad. And if, okay, so that's the... Where Plonk really wins, apart from the fact that it does better down here, is that it's all sky data over a long period, right? So that instead of dealing with this region, you're dealing with the entire sky, which is helping quite a bit. Yeah, it's good. No. There's no question that everybody's going to be trying to squeeze everything we can out of every data set that we have. So what I'm going to try and... 2007.
So it's when it launched the
satellite? Yes, right.
And all of this stuff we talked about?
At the moment. This is, not all balloons. There's actually a really vigorous ground-based program. All right, so I am going to end with a connection to the Dark Ages, which is what I wanted to talk about here. So we have learned a lot from the microwave background to put into context what this what our workshop is all about. Now, if you ionize the universe really early, let's say way back here, these curves are all, you can make very explicit predictions. Basically what happens is that the photons start to scatter out and they lose the anisotropy information that they got way back here. There's a small gaining of anisotropy information, but it's very small. The predominant effect is that you basically have a big loss, and that big loss manifests itself by this curve coming down, and once you get beyond a certain point here, it basically comes down according to the optical depth of the universe to photon plus electron scattering. Yes, except there are small changes up here. And an important change in this regime. So, if we reionize the universe at, let's say, redshift 50 even, then it would create a curve like this. At redshift 100, a curve like this. And the data now is such that that's really not possible. So that's really something very significant that's already been learned. Now, as we enter into high precision, we want to determine what this value is. And for this sort of concordance model, the relationship is tau c of about 0.1 times whenever the universe reheated divided by redshift 15 with some appropriate factor, which is something like 3/2, which basically says that we're looking for 0.1 effects. And what that means is that there's some migration down here, right? But it's not huge. But the data ultimately should be good enough to... Now, what we've done so far, we haven't done a complete analysis of this, but we have done it for the combination of the DMR data and the Boomerang North America analysis. And that has demonstrated that we have no evidence at the moment for this. And many of the models are actually preferring zero for this. So I don't want you to go away and say, therefore, the universe, it is the integral of electron density times the Thompson cross-section times c dt, right? And so there is a fair, so basically, if the universe reionizes here at redshift 15, then it's 0.1. But if it's at redshift 10, which is also quite conceivable, then it's only about 0.05, and you're looking for much smaller effects. If it was 30, it's a very large value because we've got a 3/2 factor. And so it's a very sensitive function. So that it's one of the ways that the microwave background by itself is impacting on the issue of when did structures first begin to collapse and form. Yeah. So basically we know that the universe reionized at redshift by redshift 5. And we actually have the beginnings of indications that the helium actually reionized later, maybe redshift 3 or so. So that's starting to emerge from the observations, which are quite relevant to this program. But the real question is, we know it was reionized by here. We know it must have been essentially neutral, not exactly, but essentially neutral, down here. When did it start? And then we're interested in not just this big effect, but there are also little effects associated with the different regions that would have first started to ionize here, how they would have percolated together. But those are very small effects. It's a challenge for the future for the microwave background to go after this. I'm not going to quote a number.
Does your limit on tau C now, totally just the height of the C, does that depend on the priors you have?
Exactly. Yeah, it's some models will say I would like a tau C if they predict a huge peak. And some models will say, I don't want a tau C if I predict a small peak. So it's all a function of other cosmological parameters, and there's lots of degeneracies that exist. There is an uncontrolled degeneracy between overall amplitude and tau C in this region. Right? And so all you get to break it is the DMR data, and that has problems. Very close to 100%.
Very close.
Very close. I'd say it's reasonably accurately known now from observations of the Lyman Alpha Forest. Yes, right, of course. There has to be some neutral stuff or else we wouldn't be here. Or have been.
So for the inauguration group, like over X, there are these degenerate stuff, but are those two parameters
No, it's combinations. And in fact, these are, so what was done here was something of order I think the total number of parameters was about 8 in the whole set. And these are just the marginalized out values at the end, right after you've done all of these projections. So, and I should also say that as you move in this direction with the data, you add more and more, then what are huge degeneracies here just with the first peak region become less, that you start to break them. Well, I can say right now, so there has been actually, there is a result which comes out of this which is not very significant at the moment. So one of the major graphs that people use, and that everybody may have seen this, I don't know. There is this famous omega lambda against omega matter graph, where this is 0 and this is 1, and this is the line of Einstein de Sitter universes. And the if you only know L peak, then all you can do is basically determine contours, sort of 1 sigma, 2 sigma, in this range, and you cannot get any breaking of degeneracy along this axis. Now, what we've seen in the combination of all of the data is the beginnings, but not very powerful beginnings, for the breaking of that degeneracy. So it sort of rules out extreme values here, and it actually closed up down here at 1 sigma, but it opens up at 2 sigma. So at 2 sigma, I would say you can't really say anything right now. Well, it's somewhat dependent upon the parameter space you use, to be sure. But I think that this covered that space reasonably well. It wasn't perfect, but it was reasonably well. But I would say that, you know, this is a very weak degeneracy breaking. So I don't expect that we're going to get brilliant values for omega matter alone. If you just use the peak position, you don't get any information along this line. Well, all of the other data, but except for this, of course. That's correct. Absolutely. Absolutely. However, yes. No. It's exactly the same issue. It's a question of what level. So, for example, omega total and omega lambda have a big degeneracy because it turns out that if you make omega lambda a big number, you can shift this back. You actually shift the position of the peak. And so you can then say, but you know, that was really a closed universe. Or you could say, well, that's an omega lambda, right? And so there's a certain problem with trying to distinguish those two, and that's fundamental. Except that for a small change in omega total, you have to take a huge step in omega lambda to get that, right? So a 0.1 step in omega total corresponds to about a 0.7 step in omega lambda. In other words, in broad brush stroke, you basically break it with reasonable power. That's right. I was on that paper. No. It depends what priors you put on. Yes. But I mean, there is some realism that one would. Ah, yes, right. So that's a good point. Supernova data, this thing is degeneracy is associated with what's called the angle diameter distance relationship, which is cosmologically different than what's called the luminosity distance, which is how bright, what is the luminosity as a function of distance. And that turns out to have things in this direction in terms of contours. So when you combine them together, you do localize in the omega lambda, omega m plane, and that's part of the reason for this concordance. Although, actually, you can get the same type of results by taking the information we have on large-scale structure plus the microwave background and not even care about the supernova, and you basically get focus into the same region of parameter space, which is one of these issues of why it's concordant. Everything is pointing in the same direction at the moment. Anyway, so for those of you who were completely bored, this, I hope, entertained you, because that's the most entertaining thing in town. I would say it's exactly like physics. It is, yes. Right. With a lot of collateral information as well, right, that feeds into this. I mean, so let me. One of the most amazing things to have to do here is that signals are strong relative to the noise. And what you have to do is to take the information you get that comes from the balloon, satellite or whatever, and split, just from how you've done the observation, split signal and noise apart and say, this corresponds to noise, this corresponds to signal. That is a challenge. That is a challenge that basically, at some level, hadn't had to be addressed before in full detail. Now the quality of the data is such that we have to. Every experiment now on is basically going to have to do this operation because it's all, so the satellite experiments. So there are a lot of people who are thinking about it. One of the reasons to defend our speed on the boomerang, one of the reasons is that there are things that are being done that have not been done with the data before, and that's a good thing, not a bad thing. That is to say, it's a really impressive pipeline, if we do say so, that's been put in place to try and separate the signal and the noise and try and figure out how to do the analysis with the ultimate goal, the cosmic parameters. One of the issues is how bad the foregrounds are. Some of the internal evidence looking like it's all under control. And so I think, you know, it's...
I think is the question that you're getting at, you know, there's a couple steps that go here, right? The raw data goes to the man, right, which is a typical step. And then there's the step that takes the mass to a power spectrum, which is the here, right? And then there's a step that goes from the power spectrum to cosmological parameters, right? And so my answer depends on which step you're talking about. Certainly, you know, when we publish a power spectrum and we go and, you know, and get cosmological parameters out of it, that power spectrum will be, as soon as they let us publish, you know, be public, right? And then
now,
people
can
go back and go and
do more. It sounds to me like a lot of modeling has been done before.
No, actually, that's not the case. I mean, not theory-dependent modeling. So. Actually, it's an important aspect for this large amount of data that we think is actually quite robust. So there's been, as he says, the step to making the map. That's something that's required a lot of effort. Map to power spectrum required a lot of effort. The interesting question, what we used to do is go from map to parameters directly because we said you had to take everything into account. We've been able to show that it appears that you can go from map to power spectrum in bands to parameters and get essentially the same answer. Now what you will get when things are released is that 100,000 theorists will go from, well, maybe slated. There will be 100,000 papers. Two theorists. They will take these values with correlated errors between the bands, and they will all process their own favorite parameter space, but universally using the following assumption. Gaussian distributed, because that's what you can do easily, and that's what actually goes into some of the assumptions of these error bars here. So that's what a lot of people will jump on. Who will have the stamina? Well, first of all, you have to deal with the experimentalists directly to go from time stream to map. But once the maps are done and if they're released, people could go through the same kind of analysis. And there will be a lot of people who will be clamoring. And then the question is when, but there is going to be a lot to do with this data. Search for non-Gaussian signatures, best methods for getting rid of foregrounds, all sorts of things that will be done. It's from a sequence of maps, putting them all together with the appropriate correlations to try and get rid of foregrounds, to clean up any residuals that might still be there. Mm. Are you saying you don't trust this, David?
Maybe another way to ask the question is the large number of energy is the fact that you're sometimes in template. One thing to say, everybody looks at it, everybody doesn't do this right.
Yeah, of course.
A real, I mean, the premise is so large, so simple, that you can say it's more like any data set?
No. No, 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 decidedly not. No, no, no. So you work within the context of inflation-based models, and you basically have...
Well, let's start with the scale-invariant power spectrum, right? If you're allowed to tailor the power spectrum...
Right, right. In other words, I could say there's radically broken scale invariance by some superstring-inspired model of inflation that would conspire to have a primordial power spectrum that would just cause this to go and this one, you know, right. I mean, anything could happen. The goal, of course, is, and I think Ken Minkowski probably talked about this, if you add polarization and other things, those kinds of degeneracies associated with, you know, anything goes can actually be broken.
Well, another way to say that is if you look at this map, there are several tens of thousands of different things. So, according to the model, all of them are single multivariate analysis.
Yes.
Multiplied by 15 parameters.
Yes, absolutely.
And if you are, it really is the single multivariate analysis, it's just 15 parameters. That's an amazing confirmation of the overall framework.
And we are not seeing such a thing at this stage. That there be no mistake.
Generally on this, by the time we get to 5, we will be able to determine 5 cosmological parameters better than 1%.
5 combinations. No, it's 5 linear
5
combinations. Right, because of the degeneracies that exist that can't be broken. So you determine linear combinations. And it'll be the same game that one deals with in you know, the particle physics plots where, you know, you use this experiment to, I mean, just like this, right? Supernova is going to cause this, you know, and CNB does this, and you start to localize by other information. Same thing goes here. Well, CMB at that point will be completely, would probably be completely integrated, but not that it isn't now, as a subject of ASTRO, so that people who are interested in the ISM, they'll be annoyed because the primary microwave background signal is so large, and they have to get rid of it in order to see what they care about. Similarly. There are things that are interesting to target, which is, I mean, it's not as exciting, of course, as determining the fundamental cosmological parameters associated with the structure formation model. But down here, there are these other signals that we know exist associated with, I rubbed it out, but associated with the epoch of formation of various objects. So we know that there are various signals that are sort of probing regions down here, regions here, and there's going to be a lot of work associated with trying to get what we call secondary anisotropies. So there is a target for this, and in fact that's part of the long-range NASA discussion, that this might be a good thing to go after. Planck will do polarization very well, but Boomerang, the next round of Boomerang, should get polarization as well. It's part of the experimental design. And so what we will be seeing is polarization information, not from 2010, but it'll start to come in play now. Then the question is, when we go to really fine values, what can we do to target things? So, for example, what can you do with the suppose that the cosmological constant is not a cosmological constant, but it is this quintessence thing, some kind of field with some kind of time-dependent behavior. Those things actually can have a small impact on the CL spectrum, so you would want to target different aspects to go after questions like that. And so you would be designing experiments for the physics questions of the day. Unfortunately, those things are probably not going to be able to be answered with the kind of precision that we're getting for these cosmological parameters.
But you're assuming that the experimental model that you calculate can provide
you with. I'm not, absolutely. Yes.
Can I ask a question with the data, reading that map, that if you worry about possible stuff,
It's at very high precision. It's still a worry, and one does have to clean things up. But I think I'm going to let John answer this. Actually,
we're working on it. I mean, in fact, you know, as I said, how high precision you want to go to, and I think that for mass sort of field, it's not a big worry for them, even though you know their glory channel is 19 years and have no protection for it. But, but that's something that's going to be coming out more in the next couple of years. And there have been some suppliers that have been supported in the last 5 years, and, but by and large, things have been just lower than sort of worried, well, they did worry about being here.
But there certainly will be an attempt to squeeze out whatever dust physics one can from this data, and there's already work going on in that.
Okay, well,